Today is Wednesday, October 9th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Coming up, Turkey and its Syrian rebel allies have launched a military operation into northeastern Syria. Also ahead...
It's just a scam. This is a scam by the Democrats to try and win an election that they're not going to win in 2020.
U.S. President Donald Trump has told Congress he will not comply with the House of Representatives' impeachment inquiry. So what's next? And residents in the northern part of the United States of California brace for no power for days to come. Those stories and more next. The Turkish military operation into Syria has been launched with airstrikes that will be supported by artillery fire, a Turkish security source told Reuters News on Wednesday. He was speaking after explosions rocked the town of Ras al Ain in northeastern Syria on the border with Turkey, and President Recep Tayyip Erdogan said Turkey had launched its offensive. Turkey has been poised to advance into northeast Syria since the U.S. troops began vacating the area in an abrupt policy shift by U.S. President Donald Trump, widely criticized in Washington as a betrayal of America's allies, the Kurds. In a tweet, the Turkish president's aide said that Kurdish militants could either defect or Ankara would have to stop them from disrupting Turkey's struggle against the Islamic State militants. The Kurdish-led Syrian Democratic Forces appealed to the United States and its allies Wednesday for a no-fly zone to protect it from Turkish attacks in northeast Syria. The SDF said it showed good faith to the security mechanism agreement between the United States and Syria, and it left their people defenseless. A Kurdish official says Turkey is targeting civilians in an attack on Syrian soil, and Charles Desma from the Associated Press reports.
A spokesman for the U.S.-backed Kurdish-led force in northern Syria says Turkish warplanes have started targeting civilian areas in northern Syria. Mustafa Bali of the Syrian Democratic Forces says the airstrikes have caused a huge panic among people of the region. Bali's tweet came shortly after Turkish President Erdogan announced that the Turkish offensive into northeast Syria had begun. Turkey has been massing troops for an attack against Kurdish fighters that Ankara considers a terror group. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
The United Nations Security Council is also looking to take up meeting on this issue Thursday behind closed doors and to take a look at things from a broader perspective. I earlier spoke with Craig Albert, political science professor at Augusta University. Craig, I want to get your opinion on this. We now have word that the military offensive that we have been hearing about for the past several days is now underway. What is your initial reaction to these reports?
I think that this is unfortunate, and the reports are accurate. There have been already bombing, shelling, artillery, and missiles hitting areas of Syria owned by the Kurds. This is unfortunate for several reasons. Firstly, because the Kurds have been a serious American ally in the past few years, especially against against ISIS. In fact, currently, Kurdish forces in Syria are guarding about 90,000 ISIS prisoners and their families. So now the Kurds have to reposition themselves in order to confront this Turkish incursion, leaving those ISIS prisons unguarded. So you can see the problems that are going to result initially from that. But also it shows that the U.S. commitment to the Kurds might not be that serious, and that's going to dissuade some hopes of the Kurds that have been fighting for the United States in Syria and in Iraq as well, and that could dampen the relationship moving forward.
The Kurds have actually called for a no-fly zone and called for diplomatic efforts to resolve this current situation. Moving forward, you know, we don't know what's going to happen with the conflict itself over the next few days, but what are the broader regional implications of this incursion?
There are serious consequences region-wide. So it allows for Moscow and Iran to bolster their defense of the Syrian forces, of the Syrian president. What this means is that, by the way, it also encourages Assad to compromise with the Kurds against Turkish forces. So that's something we haven't seen before, where anti-Syrian or anti-regime forces might actually team up with Syria in defense of Syrian territory against the incursion from Turkey. So that is something that would completely alter the relationships that have been happening since the civil war in Syria happened. It would also bolster Iran in the region once again, bolster Russia in the region once again, both of those, of course, being strategic adversaries of the United States. One reason the Pentagon, and especially President Trump, might allow this to happen is because President Trump wants to increase the strategic interactions between Turkey and the United States.
Turning to American politics, the decision to step aside and withdraw troops from this action in Turkey and Syria has drawn widespread bipartisan criticism here in the United States and from former administration officials. What politically is at risk for the president based on the situation?
It hurts his position moving forward. The president is determined to state that ISIS is defeated, and ISIS is just not defeated. We know they're not defeated. They're laying low. Their cyber caliphate is up and going. It is drawing in more recruits. It's very powerful. So that's one of the reasons he sees that we can pull out of Syria is that ISIS has been defeated. But the intelligence just doesn't suggest that. And with both of the parties agreeing with this and warning the president, it's going to dampen his potential foreign policy achievements moving forward. And this is something that, if he's primaried, could hurt him in the primary elections. And it's definitely going to bolster the Democratic foreign policy agenda against his foreign policy moving forward. This could hurt his presidential shots in 2020.
Dr. Craig Albers, a professor of political science over at Augusta University, thank you so much for joining us.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
Now, there's a whole lot more to my conversation with Craig Albert. And to hear it, visit voanews.com, select Live Radio, and then all programs to pick International Edition and look for today's VOA IE Extra. Two people were killed Wednesday in a shooting in the eastern German city of Halle. Police say that one person has been arrested in connection with the shooting, which local media said took place near a synagogue on the day of Yom Kippur. Several shots were fired and the suspected assailants then fled in a car, according to a police tweet. The railway station in Halle, a city of 240,000, was closed down as a precaution amid the police operation. The Philippine government imposed martial law on its giant southern island of Mindanao in early 2017 to help fight a war against Muslim rebels who had seized the center of the lakeside university town of Marawi. 2 years after the war ended, martial law remains, and officials are talking about an extension into 2020. Martial law is not new to the Philippines. Former President Ferdinand Marcos ruled as a dictator under martial law from 1972 to 1981. Three scientists won the Nobel Prize in Chemistry Wednesday for their work developing lithium iron batteries, which have reshaped energy storage and transformed cars, mobile phones, and many other devices, and reduced the world's reliance on fossil fuels that contribute to global warming. The prize went to John B. Goodenough, a 97-year-old German-born engineering professor at the University of Texas, M. Stanley Whittingham, a 77-year-old British-American chemistry professor at the State University of New York, Binghamton, and Japan's Akira Yoshino, a 71-year-old individual at the Asahi Kansai Corporation and Meiji University. Goodenough is the oldest person ever to win a Nobel Prize. A Hong Kong pro-democracy activist jailed for 6 years for rioting in 2016 appeared in court Wednesday to appeal against his sentence. Several hundred masked protesters chanting for revolution gathered at Hong Kong's High Court for the hearing. Edward Leung is among a generation of young political activists who emerged after 2014's failed nonviolent protest over Beijing's decisions to restrict elections. Leung has been an advocate of independence for Hong Kong, which reverted from British to Chinese rule in 1997. Supporters outside the court on Wednesday hoped for his release. Leung was sentenced in June of 2018 for his role in a February 2016 outbreak of violence in the city's working-class Mong Kok district. Leung's hearing could become the latest flashpoint for anti-government protests, who have staged protests for four months, and some of the protests have become massive and violent against leader Carrie Lam's administration. Lam did not rule out also asking Beijing for help in remarks on Tuesday as the Asian financial hub struggles to deal with protests that are damaging its economy. The White House is calling the Democrats' impeachment inquiry illegitimate and says it will not cooperate. AP Washington correspondent Sagar Magani has more.
The Constitution gives the House the sole power of impeachment, but gives little guidance on how to go about that. So now there's a fight over just what the founders meant. The White House argues the current process is a farce because Speaker Nancy Pelosi did not call an official vote to move ahead with the inquiry. But again, the Constitution does not call for a vote, and a House Judiciary Committee lawyer says the House gets to set its own rules. As the wording battle plays out, the White House is essentially declaring war by saying no administration officials or information will be available. Democrats say they could then write an article of impeachment on obstruction of justice. Sagar Magani at the White House.
Now joining us live to break things down is David M. Barrett, professor in the Political Sciences Department at Villanova University. David, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Steve.
So I just wanted to get your initial reaction to the White House's strategy of calling the impeachment inquiry illegitimate and saying it will not cooperate.
Well, it's certainly a very interesting strategy. A nickname was developed for that sort of strategy some decades ago. It's called stonewalling. The Constitution gives the power of impeachment to the House. As I think your reporter mentioned, there are no details there, or very few details there. And so clearly the White House is following a strategy, which I think is set by the president himself now, which is to say, we're just not going to cooperate. It's not clear to me that they will stick with that strategy. If they do, then I don't want to engage in lots of predictions in my professional career, but it seems pretty obvious the House will simply make that one of the articles of impeachment. If they get zero cooperation, then the House will investigate what it can. I think fairly soon, I think Speaker Pelosi, I'm assuming, will make the choice that there needs to be a formal vote by the House. Some members, of course, will vote no. That would mean all or most Republicans. But I think that's where it's heading, is this showdown. And then what happens beyond all that gets harder to say.
Right. And the White House actually had a phone call with reporters yesterday on background. And the senior administration official said that, they wanted to really push Speaker Pelosi to have that floor vote, saying that while they did acknowledge that the Constitution was kind of vague in what the process would, they were relying on precedents that in past impeachments, yeah, there had been a floor vote. One of the things that the White House and Republicans have brought up is this idea that the minority members on the committee should have subpoena power as well to bring about their own witnesses. And I wanted to get your input on taking a look at past impeachments. What has been the breakdown and who gets to call and who has the actual subpoena power?
Well, this would remain in the category of to be determined, again, because going back to the Constitution, there's not specificity. And precedent doesn't have the same status as the Constitution itself. But having said that, on the face of it, this will not strike reasonable people as unfair or as necessarily a bad idea. I venture no predictions on what the majority Democrats will do in the House, but I think on this point, the Republicans would have some political strength to push for this power for the Republican side. it's at least on the face of it, you can, a reasonable person might say, well, okay, why shouldn't they have that? When you go back to the Nixon era, things were way more cooperative between the two parties.
It almost seems we'll see. Becoming more and more adversarial as we move down this process, especially
Way more adversarial in the Clinton era than the Nixon era, and now way more adversarial and polarized in the Trump era than the Clinton era. So.
And this is actually all coming as the United States is facing a presidential election next November as well, and this could have an impact on that.
I think, you know, basically the Democrats clearly are betting on a strategy of, number one, I think most of them believe that they are doing the constitutionally proper thing, which is to move toward impeachment. And I think they're simply betting that if indeed impeachment occurs, but a conviction by the Senate does not occur, again, that's a fairly safe bet. The betting of the Democrats is that this will harm the president in the election. The betting of the Republicans is that Democrats will be harmed if they bring about an impeachment but fail to secure a conviction and removal. Each of those bets are plausible, but they're making different kinds of bets, that's for sure.
David M. Barrett is a professor in the political science department at Villanova University. Thank you so much for your time.
Okay, Steve. Thanks.
And you're listening to VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
It looks like Saturn has edged out Jupiter as the leader when it comes to having the most moons in the solar system. A team of astronomers led by Scott Shepard of the Carnegie Institute of Science has found 20 new moons orbiting Saturn, bringing the total number to 82. Jupiter, meanwhile, has 79 moons. The astronomers say each of these new moons is about 5 kilometers wide. 17 orbit Saturn in retrograde, meaning they move in an opposite direction than the planet. The other three moons orbit in the same direction or in prograde. The Carnegie Science Institute has opened up a contest for naming the newly discovered moons. For details, visit carnegiescience.edu/namesaturn's moons. That's all in one word. Good luck. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. European officials on Wednesday struck a pessimistic chord on the hopes of a Brexit deal a day ahead of technical talks between the bloc's chief negotiator and Britain's Brexit Secretary Stephen Barclay. Philippe Lamberts, a European Parliament Brexit Steering Group member, said he didn't think a deal was possible, and Finnish Minister for European Affairs Tytti Tuppurainen told the bloc's lawmakers that a no-deal Brexit was a dangerously realistic scenario. EU Brexit negotiator Michel Barnier, however, continues to believe that a Brexit deal with the United Kingdom remains possible despite the massive gap in their negotiating positions ahead of the fast-approaching deadline. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson said he remains cautiously optimistic that the deal can be reached before that October 31st deadline. And the Times newspaper in London reported Wednesday that the prime minister may be facing a fresh rebellion in his cabinet, with a group of ministers poised to resign due to concerns that he is leading the country towards a no-deal Brexit. Bottled water, batteries, and more flying off the shelves at California stores as millions of customers prepare to go and live without electricity for days in the face of what Pacific Gas and Electric, or PG&E, called an unprecedented wildfire danger. The utility announced that it was shutting off power to 800,000 customers in 34 northern, central, and coastal California counties beginning early Wednesday to reduce the chance of fierce winds knocking down or toppling trees into power lines during a siege of hot, dry, gusty weather. Oakland Mayor Libby Schaaf stressed that the residents must be prepared for all emergencies.
We take this red flag warning extremely seriously. We all know the devastation that fires can cause. And so this is a time to be extremely vigilant.
Gusts of 56 to 72 kilometers per hour were forecast to sweep a vast swath of the state from the San Francisco Bay Area to the agricultural Central Valley and especially in the Sierra Nevada foothills, where a November wildfire blamed on PG&E transmission lines killed 85 people and virtually incinerated the town of Paradise. PG&E wildfire safety expert Sumit Singh says the decision to cut electricity is the most drastic but most prudent approach given the weather outlook.
This is the measure of last resort, and given the extreme nature of what is being forecasted, we think this is the appropriate approach from a risk reduction perspective to, again, ensure the continued safety of our customers and our communities.
The California Department of Forestry and Fire Prevention said it increased staffing in preparation for the extreme fire weather. Singh says the utility needs to upgrade and fix its equipment so massive outages aren't the norm going forward. Chinese state media slammed the National Basketball Association Wednesday, saying it is peddling in a secessionist pipe dream, escalating in a dispute between Beijing and the U.S. League. Reuters' Serena Dayaram has that story.
Chinese state media blasted the NBA Wednesday for peddling a, quote, secessionist pipe dream. It's the latest shot fired in a crisis facing the league after Houston Rockets manager Daryl Morey tweeted, "Fight for freedom, stand with Hong Kong." It sparked an angry firestorm in China. State broadcaster and tech giant Tencent have refused to air or stream exhibition games set for this week, and sponsors have pulled out. The NBA and Morey have apologized to Chinese fans, but the league has stopped short of condemning him.
The long-held values of the NBA are to support freedom of expression, and certainly freedom of expression by members of the NBA community. And in this case, Daryl Morey, as the general manager of the Houston Rockets, enjoys that right as one of our employees.
The state-owned Global Times tabloid fired off, saying the NBA was treating the Chinese market with arrogant disregard. It also suggested that, quote, it should remind Western media that for Chinese people, the Hong Kong riots are just like 9/11, which is horrible and can't be justified. But the backlash did not end there. Hours later, organizers in Shanghai canceled an NBA fan event scheduled there for Wednesday due to what they say was the inappropriate attitude of both Morey and Silver. They also dropped an open training session. Houston Rockets star player James Harden threw his support behind the NBA commissioner after a training session in Tokyo.
We all have freedom of speech. That's the world we live in. You know, everybody should. How they feel and their thought process, be able to speak it. You know, obviously some people are going to feel some type of way, some people are going to agree. That's just the world we live in. I'm here for Adam Silver.
Meanwhile, Chinese state media also set their sights on another major American export, Apple, over allegations it aided Hong Kong protesters. They argue the company allowed an app in the Hong Kong App Store that tracks the movement of police around the city. It didn't name which app, but it says it's been used by the city's protesters. All that controversy is brewing as the U.S. and China prepare to sit for major trade negotiations later this week.
That was Reuters' Serena Dayaram. More than 4,000 people have died in the Congo this year. In the world's largest measles outbreak, the United Nations Children Agency reported on Wednesday, the Central African nation is also battling an Ebola outbreak that has killed about half of that number since August of 2018. Since January, more than 200,000 cases of measles have been reported across the Congo. UNICEF said more than 140,000 involve children under the age of five, who also make up nearly 90% of the deaths. Health officials are facing many of the same challenges in the Ebola outbreak in eastern Congo that has killed more than 2,000 people. Multiple armed groups have been fighting over the mineral-rich land for decades and threatening residents. The insecurity has led to mistrust of authorities, including health workers. And that's going to do it for us today. You've been listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of our producer, Dan Brown, engineer, Misha Dubinsky, and managing editor, Kate Pound Dawson, thank you so much for joining us. You'll be able to find in-depth coverage of world events and news at the VOA News website. And don't forget, With our mobile application, you can download our stories and take them with you anytime, day or night. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Have a great day.